By the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2005 lecture series presents Family, Gender, and State in the Middle East and South Asia by Suad Joseph, Department of Anthropology, University of California at Davis, on Thursday, October 8th at 7:30 p.m. on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
It's 106, and this is the Afternoon Magazine with your guest host, David Teal. Computer and video games have a 50-plus year history, but it's only been relatively recently that they began to challenge films and television for dominance of the entertainment industry. What began as bouncing dots on a screen has turned into vast virtual worlds in which players around the world interact and create their own realities. We look at the past and future of the video game industry with our guest, Greg Palmer, producer of the recent PBS documentary, The Video Game Revolution. He's a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning writer and filmmaker at KCTS-TV in Seattle. Hello, Mr. Palmer, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you for being our guest today. I had, of course, an opportunity to watch the program. My normal hat here at WYLL is the program director for the television station.
Yeah, I know that.
So, in any case, I had a chance to watch it and enjoyed it a great deal. And I'm not just saying that as part of public television, but just as somebody who grew up with video games, I went through the whole Pong phase and everything else. So it was kind of nice to see that again. And I'm curious what prompted you to get involved with that project.
Quite frankly, it wasn't my idea. I'm at KCTS now, and they had launched into this project for about a year, and it had sort of turned into a dog's lunch. And they called me and said, Can you come help us on this? And I said, I don't know much about video games. I never was a crazy gamer in any way. And they said, oh, that's okay. We got a lot of people on the staff who know all about video games. You don't have to know about video games. You have to know how to make a television show. And I agreed on that basis. So I walked in as somebody who played Pong in 1972 and occasionally did things after that. And, of course, like every office worker in America, I've played solitaire quietly when nobody was watching. But I was not a devout gamer, and it was not a subject I would have, I can think of 30 things I would have preferred to do before video games. And what drew me to the subject was the games and the way they've gone. I mean, the last time I paid attention to video games, it was still little dots bouncing around on the screen, and now they are technically and visually absolutely spectacular. And the other thing that drew me in was the business. I mean, you said they're challenging the movie industry. They've won the challenge. Video games have made more money in America than movies have over the last 3 years. This year, $3 billion more. The fight's over. Video games win, at least so far, in terms of money made. And that's fascinating. I mean, I once described it. Winston Churchill once said, you can never get a conviction for sodomy in Britain because half the country doesn't believe it can be done and half the country is doing it. And it's exactly the same with video games in this country. Half the people you talk to think it's still Pong and Pac-Man and Q-Bert, and the other half are devoted gamers.
Yeah, you had said in the program that more than half of America plays regularly now.
That's what they tell me.
Now, we're not talking just kids anymore either, right?
Average gamer, according to the video game industry, is 29 years old, which I found at first unbelievable statistic. And the other interesting statistic is 43% of gamers now are women, whereas it was originally conceived, at least, and I think a lot of America still thinks of video games as something 15-year-old boys with bad complexions and black T-shirts are playing in the basement. It's not that anymore at all, though there are still a hell of a lot of 15-year-old boys who are down in the basement.
I'm a 40-year-old man, and I was down in the basement last night playing City of Heroes. So
really? City of Heroes is the one game we didn't mention in the whole show that I have probably heard from 50 people saying, you nuts. This is the greatest game ever made, and we're devoted. That is the one game I've heard about most as being, I mean, let's face it, there are 10,000 video games out there. In the show, we probably maximum mention 100 to 150. City of Heroes is the one we left out that everybody thinks we were stupid.
Well, it's a relatively recent addition, and certainly, yes, that was something where I was hearing about it from a lot of my friends,
right.
and everybody said, you got to play this, everybody's doing it, so I have been, and yes, it's very addictive.
I always assumed when we did this show that the reaction from gamers would be, how dare you leave out fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And that's somewhat happened. And the other thing I assumed I would hear from people say, why would anyone spend 2 hours watching a show about video games? And so we try to deal with both those things. But I always assumed that there would be people who would say, you've left out my favorite game, you idiots.
Well, you know, my viewing of the program, I mean, it seemed comprehensive from what I remember about, you know, growing up in the video game age. And I mean, I can remember the first time walking into a bowling alley and seeing I saw air hockey and Pong at the same time the first time, and you know, it was, here's just something totally new,
right?
You know,
yeah,
air hockey's no longer with us, really.
An awful lot of people in between 1971 and 1974 had eureka moments. They walked in and thought, my God, what's that? And well, as one guy says in the show, Russell DeMaria, the writer about video games, the first time he saw Computer Space, the game in the Stanford Student Union, there was nobody around it, and he and his friend went and played it and had a nice time. And then they went away for the summer work. I think they had jobs at a summer camp. They came back 3 months later, and they couldn't get to the game. There were 10 guys standing in line waiting to play it. And it was, it was just absolutely huge. You can't, it's hard to imagine how big a deal Pong was when it, in the 6 months it came out, which was why it was interesting that the whole video game industry, in one sense, went into the toilet in 1982. There's nobody to this day can tell you why that happened. It's just that somehow the industry died, and it was Nintendo that resurrected it.
I want to take a moment here to give the phone numbers. The number to call in with your questions and comments in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. You had mentioned Computer Space a moment ago, and I think a lot of people probably don't realize that was the very first coin-operated arcade game. Or video game, I should say.
Well, yeah, sort of, yeah. It was originally developed for a big mainframe computer, and then I think somebody, I forget the name of the guy, worked out a way to make it a coin-operated game. It was just in one or two places. I mean, when you talk about the first great game, there's just absolutely no question. It was Pong, even though Pong was not the first game. No matter what Nolan Bushnell wants people to remember, Pong was not the first game. It was just the first game that made everybody pay attention to the industry.
I do recall seeing one Computer Space cabinet in my life, but
yeah.
But now you had said in the show it didn't take off. That particular game didn't take off, and I thought the reason why was pretty interesting.
I wonder, it's too complex. I mean, Bushnell's brilliance was designing a game, or actually a guy named Al Alcorn really did the game, putting together a game that your dog could practically play. You put a game like Computer Space or another version of it into a tavern. Well, you got guys in there who think they've had an intellectual breakthrough when they figure out how to play air hockey. You put a game like that in there where you have to literally look at an instruction book to find out how to play it. You're going to die. Anybody could have told them that. You can figure out how to play Pong in 10 seconds, and play it for the rest of your life. I think Sid Meier, the guy who designed the game called Civilization, said the ideal game is easy to learn and impossible to master. You play it forever, trying to get better. Rather like golf.
We've got a caller on line one on a cell phone. Line one, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I hope my reception's okay.
You sound fine on this end.
I can hear you, and I'm 2,000 miles away.
I don't want to jump too far ahead of the discussion here, but with respect to online multiplayer gaming, did your research take you into the Ventrilo and TeamSpeak software programs?
No. We were doing. There's a lot of places it didn't take us.
Okay.
And I will be the first to admit that there are a lot of things about gaming, especially online gaming, and in which I am ignorant and not necessarily blissfully so. But no, I didn't get into that? What should we have done about that?
It allows players in a multiplayer situation communicate with a voice with each other. Mm. And in a lot of games, it really gives a person or a team an advantage. And I play Medal of Honor.
Do you?
And it's a World War II first-person shooter action.
Yeah, we have that game in the show, but not that aspect of it.
Okay, oh, it's just tremendous. Anyway, I'll just hang up and keep listening to the show. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that would you know, certainly increased communication between worldwide players would certainly be one of the ways, one of the places video games is going. One of the guys in the show describes video games as a chat room with a game attached. And certainly one of the appeals of online gaming is you suddenly have 100,000 friends all over the world, and they're in their best condition because they've created avatars of their best selves, and you're in your best self. And then, therefore, increased communication between gamers is clearly one of the ways video games is going to go, especially online games.
Yeah, and I mean, having played some of that, initially I was uncertain I wanted to get into that because of the fact that, you know, you don't really own the game and you have to essentially keep paying for it every month. And yet, you know, I'll have to admit, having played a couple of them now, they can be, you know, very immersive and interesting experiences.
Yeah, and $10, $20 a month isn't much for, especially for people who pay 3 or 4 hours a day. In fact, that's one of the dangers.
Right.
You already described City of Heroes as addictive. there are an awful lot of people in America right now who would not consider that a compliment, who would not consider that a good thing.
Yeah.
And I personally think the potential addictiveness of games, and especially online games, is far more of a, should be far more of a concern than violence in games.
What is being done about that? Because, I mean, you know...
Done about what? Addictiveness?
Yeah, addictiveness. Is anybody really
nothing.
Addressing that?
I mean, other than there are certainly people now talking about games should be there should be warning labels on games, just as there is a rating system now for violence in games or sexual content or whatever. There should also be a rating system for the addictiveness of games. But I think that's going to be harder to handle because basically you're asking somebody who sells a product to say, please warn people on the box of this product or when promoting this product that it may be too good. you know, it's the cigarette industry has faced that for years. Please put out all these warnings that these things will kill you while you're trying to sell them.
I do.
Sid Meier, again, in the show, says we may be coming to the point where games, in fact, are too good. But I don't know what you can do about it. One of the things that's built into an awful lot of online games is a sort of sense that if you leave us, this game is going to go on, whether you're playing it or not, and your friends, the people in your group, the people you've been having adventures with, they're going to need you. So the games are, in fact, designed to keep people playing them. I can't see any way you could legislate to say you can't do that anymore. And that's why I think the addictiveness is ultimately a bigger problem than violence. There's been violence in, you know, fictional media, fictional work since Beowulf. There has not, however, until video games. I mean, it's hard to think of. Yeah, there's a lady in Wales who's seen The Sound of Music 842 times, but she's an aberration. Video games may be the first sort of entertainment we've ever had that are not only as addictive as they are, but easily addictive. You pay your $10 a month, you can play the game 20 hours a day if you want, and there is nobody to tell you you can't.
Well, and my experience, too, with City of Heroes, and in fact, I spent entirely too much time playing it this last weekend, is that it's just because of those online games are they're open-ended. There's no specific goal. It's whatever you want to make of
sure.
it. And they're huge. And so there's just endless things to do. And, I mean, you really could virtually play forever.
Right. And some people try and go nuts. I think Seattle's one of the first places in the country, but it sure won't be the last, where there is, in fact, a particular clinic here that deals with video game addiction, run by two people, both of them in the show, who their history is alcohol addiction and drug addiction. And they suddenly realized there was this, I don't want to make them sound crass, but there was this market for people who had become addicted to video games and had ruined their lives because of it. I think that's going to get bigger, and boy, I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah. We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Line one, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd just like to make a couple of comments.
Sure.
I certainly don't disagree with the addictiveness factor. I'd like to mention that my grown 40-year-old children play EverQuest online with friends that they played Dungeons and Dragons with in high school, and they live all over the country. So that's pretty nice. But an interesting thing I just stumbled across was their daughter just got a new computer for her birthday in August, and I think it's an e-machine, and it's pretty much the standard everything you'd get at a big box store. And then she got a new version of The Sims, and it will barely support that new version, even though it's brand new.
Really?
So, and you know, they know what they're buying. They have five computers and a LAN, but despite that, they built this new game with so much graphic content that it's much slower than the old one, much.
That's
going to perpetuate bigger and better machine purchases. And I just think that's rather interesting.
Well, one of the other things, and we mentioned in the show, is one of the other reasons to pay attention to video games, if you do anything with a computer, is that the technology required to play complex games is one of the things computer manufacturers now take into account. That if you have the Champaign Urbana computer company, and you're about to put out a new computer, you make two phone calls. One of those phone calls is to Will Wright, who created The Sims, and you say, "Will, what do you need in this machine so it can play your games?" And the other one is to John Carmack, who at id Games in Texas, who created Doom, et cetera, and is a technologically cutting-edge company. And you say to him, what do you want? John Carmack gets called by any smart computer manufacturer in America that the technology required to play games is driving the technology that is going into new computers, whether mm-hmm. those computers go to grandma so she can send emails or to 14-year-olds so they can play games. So I'm, in fact, surprised that a brand new computer can't handle a brand new Sims game.
It can handle it, but it's
just
so much slower.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we did for the show was go to something called GD Fest, where people aged 14 to 60 from all over the country brought their computers, and those people were bringing in computers I'd never seen before, PCs, but they were PCs particularly designed to play games.
Mm-hmm.
And they had flames on the side and everything else.
Aren't they about $5,000?
Certainly more than I'd spend to play a video game. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they're not cheap.
Sounds as if the gamers have kind of, marginalized NASA computers.
Could be.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for your call. I want to remind folks about the phone numbers again. 333-9455 is the number inside the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, during this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, is Greg Palmer. He's producer of the recent PBS TV documentary, The Video Game Revolution. One of the things as somebody who came up through the ranks, you know, with the old arcade games, I mean, it's been a very interesting shift in the content from the old arcade games to the home systems and mm-hmm. how, you know, the actual games just play completely different. And my friends and I always complain about, you know, today's kids don't understand that, you know, back then you just died.
Yeah.
You know, there was no completing a game.
Death and resurrection.
Yeah, it was just, you know, you would just, the Space Invaders were going to get you.
Right.
And there was no getting around it.
You had very rare instances where you won.
Yeah.
And yeah. Well, it was the 3-minute experience. Those games were designed to keep you putting quarters in a machine. But when games, you know, when you purchased a whole game and you took it home and played, that, at least financial motivation, went away. To keep you taking quarters out of your pocket, and therefore the whole effort of the story changed to something to keep you playing, but not for 3-minute bursts. You didn't have to die. You still can, of course. There was also the tradition, the which I think is uniquely American, of death and resurrection in entertainment for kids. I mean, if you look at practically every Disney film, somebody dies and is resurrected. Wizard of Oz, somebody dies and is resurrected. E.T., somebody dies and resurrected. Mm. Death and resurrection are a recurring theme in entertainment for children, and therefore it was not to me a surprise that when video games first started to have characters instead of dots, that death and resurrection appeared again, and instead of just Snow White coming back the once, you can die 20 times in some of these games, and you come back good as ever, down a few points, not a surprise. But when they went home, or they went online, that ceased to be a goal of the game maker. And they found other things to do, making you the star of the story. I mean, video games really is a whole different kind of entertainment in a very real way. It is the first entertainment medium where you are, in fact, the hero of the game. You can't name, I mean, the general public, people who play games, cannot name the heroes of the video game industry, just where you go to somebody who goes to a lot of movies and they'll say, yeah, I love Cary Grant, or I love Brad Pitt, or I da-da-da-da-da. There's no such people in video games. I know who John Carmack is because I've done this show, and I know who Nolan Bushnell is because I've talked to him. But for the general public, even people who play games, they're no heroes. They're no stars. They're no people whose autograph you want to get. Why? Because you're the hero. It's you. And imagine the creative challenge of writing something where an unknown entity with at least some freedom of action is the hero. It's a remarkable challenge. I have a great deal of admiration for people who create great games. There aren't that many of them, alas. One of the people in the show, John Molyneux, who is Peter Molyneux, who is one of the great game creators, says 90% of all video games are about as artistic as a traffic accident. And he's exactly right. But that 10%, there is some remarkable things being done by people like Sid Meier, by Molyneux, who creates God Games, by Will Wright with The Sims.
Mm-hmm. We've got another caller on line one from Champaign. Champaign, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question. There's a place in Hollywood, Florida, called Boomers that has all like the old video games. It's a, like amusement park slash video game mecca. And I just was wondering why, like in Illinois or in the Midwest, they don't have something like that where you put all the Pac-Mans, all the Golden Axes, all everything in one massive amusement park like Boomers, and so people who remember the day in the 80s when you would go to a video arcade place and there would be actual people, not just like one or two people, there'd be like, you know, the half the town. Why that's not the case? Why no one's done that in the Midwest?
Boy, I'm surprised no one has. I should think I would have thought in the top 30 cities in America, somewhere somebody had an arcade, maybe not a huge one, but had an arcade where Pac-Man was next to Pong, was next to Golden Axe, et cetera. Well, that's certainly the case here.
But
one of the
Hollywood,
people we profiled
Florida,
was a guy who restores and distributes to taverns, et cetera, old video games. And I've certainly read things in the press, literally in the last 3 months, that the old games are coming back.
But what I'm saying is, in Boomers is like more than just video games. It's got skee-ball. It's like, you know, got everything. Bumper cars.
It's like walking into your life when you were 14.
Yeah.
It's a time machine. Sounds like a great place.
What I'm saying is, you know, someone has to put it in the Midwest so you don't have to go to California, New York, or Hollywood, Florida.
Right. Well, I'd agree with that.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, it sounds like a great idea. I know there used to be an arcade museum, I believe in St. Louis, that had you could actually play the exhibits. I believe, unfortunately, it is now closed. But and of course, a lot of those the old games now are being resurrected. You know,
they're being resurrected in interesting ways too. One of the things we had here was you can buy a joystick that has Pong and four or five other games sort of built into it on chips. And they're not bad recreations of the old games. The problem is, of course, the joystick goes through its four AA batteries in about 4 minutes.
Yeah,
you spend a lot of batteries on that baby. But there are a lot of ways now. I mean, I get trash emails daily about Pong is back. Yes, buy a Pong machine from us. That kind of stuff. So I think there is some thought that they're coming back, and it makes sense that for us aging types, I'm more aging than you, but for us aging types who don't particularly want to go into the complexities of Myst or EverQuest or whatever, that there is something, well, Nolan Bushnell says it in the show, there's something kind of satisfying about the good, tight 3-minute experience.
Right.
Well, we'll see. Everything he's touched since Atari has turned to dust, so maybe he's right finally.
Well, I know one thing, and I'm sure you hear this too, and we're both in the television business, and a lot of things have been said over the years about the convergence between computers and television. And
right.
To me, the real convergence seems to be between movies and video games, where each seems to be looking more and more like the other all the time.
Absolutely. And the Hallmark film, 20 years from now when we're looking back at how this happened, the Hallmark film will be the Matrix movies.
Mm-hmm.
They had $20 million more in the budget for the film and shot for something like 35 or 40 more days footage with the stars of the film, not for the film, but for the video game. The video game was part of the production from the beginning on that movie, and any kind of action-adventure movie that's made from now on, the producers would be nuts not to be working on the video game at the same time. We have obvious cases where movies have been made from video games and obvious cases where video games have been made from movies. But more and more, I think, in the future, it's going to be a package. And who's going to object to that? I read a statistic, which may be incorrect, that, what's her name, Will Smith's wife, she only made like $5 million on the Matrix movies.
Right.
But she had a percentage of the home videos of the video game sales, and has made more than $80 million on the video game.
Well, I know. I mean, two things that leap out to me as recent examples. I mean, one just opened in the theaters a couple of weeks ago, the Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow feature film that in some ways, and not to denigrate it, but it looks very much like a video game.
You bet it does.
And
yeah. It's an entirely blue-screen film.
Yeah. And then on the other hand, there was a game by Electronic Arts, a James Bond game called Everything or Nothing, where they cast it and created it as a movie, though there is no movie that it's based upon, but they cast it with real stars who look like the people and all that. And to me, that was fascinating to actually mount a movie-based game that really wasn't even based on a movie.
Yeah, and there's just going to be a lot more of that, especially as there are more video games out there. Anything to give your game a hook, anything to make your people pay attention to your game rather than the next game down the slot, it's a simple marketing question. It doesn't have at least much to do with the artistic quality of the game. It has to do with trying to get it sold.
Sure. We have another caller from Champaign on line one. Champaign, you're on the air.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
Sure can.
I just wanted to make two comments. In Champaign, back in the 80s, early 80s, there was a large video arcade, and it's since gone away, but it had a lot of very, I'm not quite sure if that's what you mean by video arcades, but it had so-called state-of-the-art games at that time. And on Play-Doh, I don't know if you're familiar with Play-Doh, it was a university system, computerized system.
What system?
Play-Doh, P-L-A-T-O.
Sounds vaguely familiar, yeah.
A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, there was a game called Empire.
Yeah.
And it had the Federation and the Romulans and the Orions and all that. And I don't know if you've ever heard of that game, but that was one of the most addictive space games I've ever seen.
I used to play something like that at Ball State. It was a similar kind of thing. You were just like a letter on a screen, and you were firing commas at the other guy.
Well, actually, they had their own ships.
Oh.
They played 30 ships and take over the universe and torp people and cloak and great days.
But that's the business.
Yeah. I just wanted to make the comment. But
thanks.
Thank you.
You tell me, you're an old Dungeons & Dragons player, right?
Yeah.
Do you find the experience of playing City of Heroes by yourself staring at a screen as fulfilling as you find playing Dungeons and Dragons with friends?
You know, it's interesting, and I was kind of mulling something similar through my mind this morning, preparing for the interview, in that one of the things that these games have in common, the online role-playing games and the actual, you know, dice and paper role-playing games, is that sense of teamwork. You have to work together with other players against a common threat, and everybody has their little role, you know, within that team, that there are different archetypes of characters, and so... So in that sense, yes, but I mean, obviously you don't know. In fact, with this game specifically, I have no idea who any of these people are.
Well, yeah, and that's it. Is you're able to, you don't lose too much by the fact that your team members are not in the same room with you, that they may be 10,000 miles away.
Not so much. I mean, I have no idea, you know, what their ages, sexes, or anything is. I mean, I suppose if, you know, we spent more time chatting, it'd be one thing. But a lot of, in this particular game, a lot of the teams are just made on the fly and dissolve within the space of an hour or so. And so you never really get a chance to know anybody, but it's still kind of interesting. The interaction is interesting. And, of course, everybody is, well, it's as they say on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. And I always love that. You know, we probably should at least address the topic of video game violence. I hesitate to bring it up because it tends to be contentious and, there's a lot of argument about it. But, I mean, you know, well, clearly there are some video games that are very violent, although that's a pretty limited subset of this. But, I mean...
Yeah, the thing that makes a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people, but makes the sort of anti-violence in video games people tense is that some of those very violent games, obviously Grand Theft Auto and Doom being the two classic examples, are also extremely popular games. The simple fact is that the majority of video games are not violent. But in the top 10 video games, two of them, Grand Theft Auto and Doom particularly, and I'm sure there are others, are extremely violent, always have been. And then the other thing is they are both absolutely cutting-edge games.
Yeah, they're very
I've had
good.
People who are even against violence but know a lot about games who will tell you Grand Theft Auto has changed the way games will be simply because it is so beautifully designed and it gives the player so much more freedom of movement, freedom of action than its predecessors. And the unfortunate thing is most of that action is bashing people to death with ball bats and stabbing them and throwing bombs and things like that. So it's not... I think people who are realistic about this say it's not that all games are violent. It's that the violent games have such a distinct attraction, and particularly an attraction to people who are perhaps already prone to violent behavior.
And that is, you know, of course, obviously the most infamous example was the Columbine shootings.
You bet.
And, you know, and some critics of video games leapt at that because those kids not only played Doom, but they actually kind of modeled their high school within the game.
They did. And one of their guns was named for Doom. And clearly they were Doom players. And people who wish to make a point of that claim that what they did was go into the school and recreate a scene from Doom or Doom-like scenario, but with real bullets and real victims. Others say, yeah, they were Doom players, but, you know, they also chewed Juicy Fruit gum. And one of the points, which I think, I mean, God knows I'm not defending violence in video games, but one of the points I think is important, and I made it in the script of the show, yeah, they were Doom players, but just like every other person who's freaked out in a high school, they were all the victim of bullies.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally think bullying is a far more serious problem than kids who go home and play violent video games. The great majority of the research shows that if you are prone to violence, fictional violence or viewing violence may in fact exacerbate your tendency to commit violence. But if you don't have any real problem with that in the first place, it won't.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the thing that I find interesting is that we focus on the two kids or the handful of kids or people who go out and commit some act and who happen to be players of a certain game. But on the other hand, there are millions of people playing these games who don't go out and do those
things. Absolutely.
So,
and there are millions of people who get very great benefits from games, whether violent or not, mostly nonviolent games. You know, there are people who are handicapped, who are shut in, who are able to live, to put some excitement, some interest, something to do with their lives, albeit cyber lives, because of games.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think those people should be forgotten in any discussion of, okay, how are we going to keep these games from messing up our society? There are problems with games, and they should never be ignored, just like anything that's that powerful culturally in our society should be ignored. But there has to be some sort of reason with it as well.
We've got a caller on line one. Line one, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I have two questions. I will hang up and listen to the answers.
Okay.
When did ping pong become first commercially available?
Ping pong mean actual on the ping pong board, as opposed to pong?
No,
the video game.
The video game on the CRT screen.
Pong first came out in 1972 in California and then spread across the country. But it was an arcade game. It wasn't at home.
So that would have been perhaps a Christmas gift in...
The Christmas gift they were giving in 72 was a thing called the Magnavox Odyssey, which was the first home console and played four or five very simple games.
And
invented by a guy named Ralph Baer. And it actually preceded Pong. Pong went to homes through Sears in 73, 74.
Okay. And what's the next logical step for a replacement of the joystick? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I'm not sure I understood that. What's the next logical step for the replacement of the joystick?
I guess in terms of maybe just controllers, you know.
There will always be joysticks. There is a tactile joy to the joystick that no video game maker, especially an arcade game maker like that, would ever be stupid enough to lose. The joystick and the ball will always be with us. I could go into the whole sociosexual aspect of that, but I won't.
Please don't.
No. But there is one.
Yeah, we have an FCC to worry about now.
Yeah.
We have another caller on line four from Belgium. Line four, you're on the air.
Yes. To talk about a different aspect of gaming that you're... I don't know if you guys have even thought about it. I'm related to some people who are involved with independent record labels. And anymore, there's a big demand for songs to put on video games.
Mm. Right.
And there's people make serious money with their songs, even though their songs may not hit the mainstream. Their songs make a lot of money. And interestingly, there's a subset of this group that don't want their songs on there because they think it's degrading to their songs, which is kind of an interesting concept, too.
It's not only interesting, but it's deja vu all over again. It's exactly what happened in the movie industry when sound came in.
Mm-hmm.
There were some people who wanted to put good songs in movies, and did, and wanted to hear their music in movies, and other people, Broadway composers, etc., who thought the music in most movies was awful. It was badly reproduced. The focus was taken away from the music by people looking at the pictures and therefore wanted nothing to do with it. And this is another example, and there are many examples, of the video game industry repeating the history of the movie industry. And the only difference is the video game industry has moved a lot faster. Video games have been around for 35 years. If you look at movies after they'd been around for 35 years, they had just barely started sound. Picture was still black and white, mostly. And not very good, whereas look at what the video game industry has done in the last 35 years. And one of the things that's going to happen in the next 5 years, 10 years, is I think the quality of music, the composers of the music, etc., will improve a lot. Most of the music in video games now is dreck. It's god-awful. But there are some noted exceptions, and it's going to get better. For the same reason it got better in movies. Composers finally said, can't fight it, going to join it.
The reason I think the video games came along so quickly is that we've had a great increase in technology since the start of the movie thing.
Absolutely.
Which we all
whereas
learned
you didn't have that increase in technology in the early part of the century on film. A guy in the show, what's his name? Forget his name. He's a game designer. He says what's great about working in this industry is that every 2-3 years it's a whole new ballgame. there's a whole new technological advancement for that we get to play with. That certainly wasn't the case in the movies.
That's true. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for
Did
your call.
Belgium?
I don't believe the country. but in any
was there a Belgium, Illinois that I don't know
there,
about?
There apparently there is.
My father was born and raised in Carlinville. Never been there.
Honestly, I'm an Indiana boy myself, so I did not know that, but I'm happy to know it now. We just have just a few minutes left. One of the things I thought was very interesting was in the program you talk about the way that the U.S. Army is using a video game as a recruitment tool.
Yeah. I left out the paranoid part. There is a paranoid part that's fascinating.
Really?
So the Army puts out this game called America's Army, or I forget what it's called.
Yeah.
And it's a video game that you can, I mean, millions of people play this game now. I interviewed a guy and I just couldn't use it because it was just so far-fetched, but these days, who knows, that the Army has buried in this game a way so it can monitor how you play it, whether you're good at it. And if you're really good at it, that's when the recruiter calls. is so wonderfully America as she is today. People, kids who play this game who think, the Army's really watching me. There was an old movie called The Last Starfighter. Remember, it was that plot. They put video game down, this alien race. They watch the way people play it, and people who really play it good, they swoop down. Robert Preston, if I recall, was the alien recruiter.
Yes.
Swoop down, grab the kid up so he can be the last starfighter. Well, there are some people who believe that the Army's recruiting game does that the same. Other people are just concerned that the Army is spending taxpayer money to give to albeit subtly, use a violent game, and it is violent in some ways, to recruit folks into the Army. The anti-violence people are not pleased by the Army's game.
Yeah, it's just a very interesting use of the technology, and I guess probably not all that surprising in a way. But
not in the least. I mean, the Army was already using video game simulations to train folks already in. Why not use video games to show what life in the Army is like and make it look good?
Yeah. One of the things that, of course, has been implemented in, I forget what year it started, but the video game rating system. Do you think that that's been effective in teaching parents or keeping kids from playing inappropriate games?
I think Pam Eakes, who is the head of Mothers Against Violence in America, she would say to you that it has been partially effective. It has made a lot of parents more aware of what their kids are buying or what they're buying for their kids. There are some retailers who are paying attention to it and not selling the equivalent of X-rated or R-rated games to young kids. She would say it has not been effective because not enough parents have paid attention to it, and especially because retailers, unlike movie theater operators, kid walks in, he's got his $20, you sell him the game, you don't care what it says on the front. Her organization sent some high school kids who were part of the organization to a bunch of retailers to try to buy restricted games. And 4 out of 5 stores, there was no problem. They walked up and bought the R-rated game.
Yeah. We have a caller on line one, and you have to be very quick, line one.
Okay, I tuned in just in time to hear the fellow talk about Plato, and if the guest is interested in the history of games, computer games, it really is worth looking into the Plato phenomenon.
Okay.
And a quick way to do that is if you Google on the name Brian Deere, BrianDeear.
D as in dog, EAR?
Right.
Okay.
He's writing a book about this history, and he has a website with a lot of stuff on it.
Well, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, caller. And that, unfortunately, is going to wrap it up for us today. Our guest on the Afternoon Magazine during this hour was Greg Palmer. He was the producer of the recent PBS TV documentary, The Video Game Revolution. You can find that program on home video by visiting KCTS's website, and that is www.channel9store.com. That's channel with a 9, store.com.
There's a heck of a website for the show, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I had no connection to other than advising on it, but it's a marvelous website, I'm told.
And that is, you can find that on www.pbs.org.
Right.
I forget. From there, you can search for it. It's just Video Game Revolution. You can find it that way. Thank you very much for being our guest today.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you. Again, this is David Thiel for The Afternoon Magazine. Executive producer is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. You're listening to WILL, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Next up is Todd Gleason with the settlement prices from the Board of Trade.
Thank you very much, David. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the corn pit tumbled just in the last 15 minutes to finish the day a little bit lower, down about a penny and a half to a penny and a quarter in those nearby contracts. Soy complex finished the day a bit higher for the day, and the wheat futures were up. December contract 4 cents higher at the end of the day. In fact, 321.5 the high for the wheat, the low at 316.25. December wheat, a settlement price today at 319.75. Once again, they were four higher. The March futures, 333.5 high, low at 328, settled 332.75, five higher. And the May contract, a 337.25 high, low at 334, settled 337. They were up 4 cents on the day. July futures in the wheat pit, 341 the high, the low at 337.5. A settlement price at 340, they were up 3.25. From the corn pit today, futures settled like this. 210.25 the high, the low at 206.75, and the settlement price for the December corn at 207.25, down 1.25. Most of that loss, all of that loss, in fact, happening in the last 15 minutes of trade today. March futures, a 221 high, low at 217.75, settled at 218, a penny and a half lower. And the May futures, 228 the high, low at 224.75, settled 225.25, down 1. July futures, 234 high, low at 231, settled 231.25, down a penny and a quarter. And the September, 240.5 high, low at 237.5, settled 237.75, down 1 for the day. And December contract, 247.5 high, low at 245.25, settled 245.5, and they were off a half cent for the day. Oat futures now, 151 the high, the low at 146.5, and the settlement price for the December contract a half higher at 146.75. March 158 the high, low at 153.5, settlement there. Down on that low at 153.5, it was still a half cent higher for the day. November beans, 539.5 the high on the trade, the low at 533. Settlement price at 533.5, they were two higher. And the January ranged from 547.5 high, the low at 540.5, and settled at 540.75. They were up a penny and a quarter for the day. March futures at 554.5 high, low at 547.5, settled a half cent above that at 548. Up 1.25, and May contract, 554.5 settlement price, up 1 for the day. Their high, 561, the low at 554. July soybeans at 567, the high, low at 560.75, settlement price a quarter of a cent above that at 561 even, up a half cent. Bean meal now. October contract finished the day 30 cents higher, had a high of 159.90, a low at 158.30, settled at 158.50. They were up 30. And the December bean meal, a 163.50 high, low at 162.10, settlement price there at 162.30. They were up 70. October bean oil, 21.15 high, low at 20.80, settled 20.81. They were off 4 for the day. And December bean oil, 21.19 the high, the low at 20.80, settled 20.82. And they finished a penny lower for the day. Coming up during the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, about all the things that happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. We'll take a look at LDP with him as well. And then later in that program, we'll hear about the new semi-permanent Farm Progress show site. We'll talk with the folks from Farm Progress Publications. That all coming up during the closing market report this afternoon. Stay tuned with us here on WILL Urbana. Now, up with the Mercantile Exchange numbers is the host of the rest of the afternoon magazine for the day, Tom Rogers.
Thanks a lot, Todd. And up is the right word, except for one contract in feeder cattle. We had an update on the Merc. September feeders had a high today of 114.90, the low 114.70, settled at 114.80. That was down 7.5 cents. And then up for the rest of the market. October feeder cattle, a high today 112.40, the low 110.90. Settlement at 112.17.5, that's up 97.5. The November contract at a high of 110.40, the low 109.15. Settled at 110.12.5, up 65. Over to the live cattle pit now. September live cattle didn't trade. October had a high of 85.95, the low 83.90. The settlement at 85.90, up 180. And December, the high 88.25, the low 86.50, settled at 87.92.5, up 127.5. In the lean hog market, the October contract had a high of 74.85, a low of 73.70, settled at 74.50. That was up 30. December lean hogs, the high 69.40, the low 67.80, settled at 68.57.5, up 75. February, the high 67.30, the low 65.50, settled at 66.67.5, up 137.5. And the April lean hog contract at a high today of 65.20, a low of 63.10, settled at 64.60, up 135. February pork bellies had a high today of 97.35, the low 93.80, settled at 96.72.5, up 177.5. And quick look at the stock markets right now. The Dow is up about 19.5 points at 10,097. The NASDAQ up almost 20 as well at 1890 rather. And the S&P up a penny and a half, or up 1.5 at rather points at 1111. And those are the closing market numbers from the Merck, as well as some updates from Wall Street.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Amy Shaver from Columbus, Ohio writes, "Dear Dr. Science, how can I get my husband to quit listening to Dr. Science?"
You can't. He's on a mission from God. And if you attempt to interfere with that mission, you risk disaster. I've run into his type before. He feels he has nothing to lose and is backed up against the wall of his own ignorance. I'm his only hope. Come to think of it, maybe you ought to secretly file for divorce and then just go out for a loaf of bread and fail to come back. If he's as far gone as you say he is, chances are he won't notice you're missing for quite some time.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK or visit us on the web at www.drscience.com.
Queen Latifah is heading a new direction, trading in rap for Rhapsody.
Life is lonely.
9 times out of 10, I would just go in that booth and feel that song. And whatever came out was cool with me because I don't necessarily want perfection. I just want what's natural.
Queen Latifah today on All Things Considered from NPR News.